the DEA agent had a few different meetings with him. And tonight at 10 o'clock was a meeting on top of the overpass. And the meet did happen, but it didn't go as planned.
We also were running down leads on the van, and we were searching to see if we can find, actually locate the van.
Mobsters, gangs, they never talk. They never rat out anyone, and sort of dismissive of law enforcement coming to talk to them.
Hey, this is Justin and Aaron from the Generation Y podcast, where we explore hundreds of unsolved murders and conspiracy theories. This week's episode, we dive into the murder of Jason Kopack. Jason and his friend Brian Simmons played D&D and listened to heavy metal music. Brian Simmons bragged about being a Satanist and would end up bragging to his friends about the murder of Jason Kopack. Listen to the Generation Y podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the Wondery app. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
Hello, and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds, and FBI profiler. And with me today is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, we have two people on the podcast with us today. One, of course, our crack producer, Josh Murphy. Say hi to everybody, Josh.
Hello, everybody. I could listen to you guys introduce yourself just numerous times. I just love it so much.
You sure, Francie, that he's a crack producer and not a meth producer?
I think it's crack. I think crack because it's easier for me.
Okay.
We have a really special guest, a return guest, a fan favorite, someone who is in so much demand on Best Case, Worst Case, Jim, that I feel like you and I could retire and let him take over and people would be jumping for joy.
Well,
and he is?
Let's talk about that.
James R. Fitzgerald, glad to be here, guys. I'm going to ask you for a raise or a promotion or something. You keep building me up this way.
I know. It's just sad that we pay you nothing, Fitz.
Can I at least get minimum wage, whatever that is now in this state?
I think baked goods is all.
Glad to be here, though, with everyone, including Josh.
Well, and Jim, this is so exciting because we have Fitz on to talk about a case that you both were involved in. It's another case of the Jims, but what's really interesting about this, our listeners are going to love, is there is a mob connection with a man people might be familiar with named Sammy the Bull Gravano. But we're not going to spoil it yet, Jim. We're going to just let Fitz tell us about the case.
Okay, Fitz. So let's talk about this. Where were you in your career, which I might add would be the same place that I would have been in my career, but where were you in your career when this case reared its ugly head?
Yeah, Jim, as you said, both of us were kind of in the same place. We were about a year out of the academy and almost to the week, actually. And we were both in the New York division on the bank robbery squad, the Joint Bank Robbery Task Force, C-19 for short.
That's and, FBI, NYPD, Joint Bank
Robbery. Right, that's right. Half detectives, about 10 detectives, 10 FBI agents. And we worked together great doing all kinds of violent crimes, criminal violent crime type offenses, bank robberies, kidnappings, extortions. And on occasion, the murder or assault of a federal employee, being a judge or certainly a law enforcement agent, as in what happened in the story we're about to tell.
What was the first thing that happened in this case?
Sure. And it happened around 10 o'clock at night on February 28th of 1989. And that is the murder of a Drug Enforcement Administration agent named Everett Hatcher. He was an Army veteran, but also in the DEA for about 10 years. And he had been working a mob wannabe named Gus Ferace or Ferracci, depending, people pronounce it all both different ways, but a mid-20s, late-20s steroid freak junkie who was looking to get into the drug business, kind of working without the official approval of his mafia bosses. And the DEA agent had a few different meetings with him, recorded phone calls, and tonight at 10 o'clock, the 28th, was a meeting on top of the overpass of the Staten Island Expressway, kind of remote area. And there's supposed to be a meet there, and the meet did happen, but it didn't go as planned.
And Fitz, I think people don't know sort of the structure of the Department of Justice and why the FBI would be involved at all with something that's a DEA operation that's gone bad. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The DEA would have run the drug operation on their own with no FBI involvement necessarily. It could happen down the line, depending on the case. But in terms of federal statutes and the violations where individual agencies are charged with, the murder of any federal agent in the line of duty, and I'm clarify this, maybe even not in the line of duty, falls under the jurisdiction of the FBI. And in the FBI, in the New York office, that was specifically Squad C-19, the one to which Jim and I were assigned. Therefore, the calls coming in at 1:30 the morning of March 1st to both of us.
Yeah, Fitz, I remember I was actually the duty agent on the squad that night and caught the case. And I got a call that there had been a shooting and it was a federal agent, a DEA agent involved in the shooting, and he was injured. And I actually immediately responded to the scene out in Staten Island. It took some time because in order to get from Manhattan to Staten Island, you either have to take a bridge into Brooklyn and then go around and take the bridge from Brooklyn into Staten Island, which takes a fair amount of time, or take the Staten Island ferry at the South Point of Manhattan. And I believe that day I took the Staten Island ferry just because I thought it would be quicker. And when I arrived on the scene, they had already removed Everett Hatcher's body. And there were very few law enforcement officers there at the time. Of course, NYPD had a presence there, and the entire overpass was cordoned off with police tape. And I was the first FBI agent on the scene. And when I remember vividly, unfortunately, approaching Everett's car and sort of starting the initial crime scene evaluation. And I remember finding, without being too graphic, pieces of Everett's skull and scalp on the street. And it was very, very sobering. And I remember sometime after that, when you arrived, and I believe then you and I we were in the same car then. I think you joined me in my car, and we ended up spending the next several days in Staten Island and running around covering leads and doing surveillance and doing some interviews. And there were some crazy things that happened, as I recall. But I'll let you talk about when you arrived on the scene.
Yeah, my partner on the squad was a guy named Rich Finelli, and he happened to buy a house in Ben Salem where I had already been living. So our commute to the scene wasn't that easy either. Coming up the Jersey Turnpike, I think we crossed the Outer Bridge crossing into Staten Island. But we show up there, and most of our squad was already there, including you, Jim, and there's a number of lights and blue lights, red lights, amber lights, everything that you can imagine. It's cold weather, so the vapors from the car, from people's breath, it was just so strange. But the supervisor called us over, John Coleman, and he said, all right, we have a dead DEA agent, and we know who the killer is. Here's his picture. It's a guy named Gus Farace, or Farace, because the DEA knew exactly who Everett Hatcher was dealing with. That's who the meet was with. So the identification of the suspect was not that difficult. I mean, we sought to prove our case, but he was out on parole. He was obviously in violation of a number of things. They have recordings of him talking drugs to Everett Hatcher. So it'd been easy to pick him up for the parole violation. But of course, he was now the prime suspect in the DEA agent's murder also.
Fitz, so let me ask you a question. So this was 1989, and you talked about this Farace or Farace being kind of a wannabe mobster. I said at the beginning of the podcast that implicated in all this might be a story by Sammy the Bull Gravano. So let's talk about the state of the mob for a second. I mean, I know you and Jim both have lots of experience with this. What was going on with the state of the mafia in New York at the time of all this? And why would some low-level or wannabe mobster be getting into the drugs business?
Well, as many of your listeners may know, and I know Jim knows this, certainly during that time frame, there was five major families in New York City: Bonanno, Gambino, Genovese, Colombo, and Lucchese. They're the ones that ran different enterprises, different criminal activities throughout, and they were divided by geography, by what kind of crimes they were doing, whether it's hijacking, prostitution, numbers, whatever it was. And they all had their hierarchy, their fealty, and they knew exactly how they were set up. And there were made mobsters, there was made guys or soldiers, as they're known. And John Gotti was really the head of the five families at this point. But each family had their own capos, their own lieutenants, and their own soldiers. So that's kind of the ranking order. But this Gus Ferrace was none of those. He was a low-level wannabe. He was a nephew of, I think, some made guy. And he was really a rogue. He was already in prison once for murder. He beat some guy to death. And in prison, he made friends with a capo in the Bonanno family named. So a capo is like a captain, above lieutenant, but below, the top person, the Don, I suppose. And he supposedly got friendly with a guy named Jerry Chili. And Jerry Chili, this capo in the Bonanno family, sort of took him under his wing. But he was going out doing these drug type things. And Sammy the Bull had a story about him, too, which is kind of interesting from his perspective that perhaps we can talk a little bit more later in our episode.
So Fitz, as I recall, once we got the photograph of, I'll call him Farachi because that's how I referred to him, that we then started basically running down leads of where his different relatives lived. And we also were running down leads on the van. So the DEA had a license plate for the van. And you and I, along with all the rest of our squad mates, were just searching everywhere for every home that we knew that was associated with Farachi or with that van. We were searching to see if we can locate the van. And eventually we did, you and I. Do you recall that?
I remember we might have been 2 days later in the morning, that van was located without the tag on it in somebody's driveway
right.
in Staten Island, backed all the way almost out of sight. But somehow we had information that at least put us in a certain neighborhood. And that was one of the first big breaks in the case, was finding that van. And I know you were a part of that.
Yeah, and Fitz, that actually really highlighted one of the major issues with this early investigation. I don't know if you recall, but we did locate that van, and it was actually, yes, like you said, the license plate was removed, but we were able to confirm the year and then the VIN number through a little surreptitious surveillance. And we ended up radioing in to John Coleman that we had located the van. He was very, let's say, covetous of the credit that would go to the agency that solved this case. I think he really wanted it to be an FBI solution because Hatcher was a federal agent, DEA agent in the Department of Justice. And he made you and I actually drive to pick up two other agents that were coming across. I don't know if they were just coming across on the ferry and we had to pick them up and then drive back to the location before we approached anybody at that location. And when we rolled back up to that location and were preparing to knock on the door and do an interview and determine if the owner of that van, which was a young guy who lived at that location, if he was there and we were going to interrogate him. So as we pulled up and got out of the car, the front door opened and somebody stepped out on the front porch with a very visible gun on his hip. And that really made us respond. So we pulled our guns and kind of got cover behind our car and called out that we were FBI.
Thank you. We could all use a little help when things start to feel overwhelming. And stress looks different for different people. Maybe you're bogged down by your to-do list, feeling a little detached, or just feel stuck. Talkspace has thousands of licensed therapists in over 40 specialties, including depression, anxiety, relationships, and many more. Whatever you need support with, you'll have someone on your side to help you set your goals and stay accountable to achieving them. Talkspace is a fraction of the cost of in-person therapy, and instead of waiting for your appointment, you can send unlimited messages to your therapist 24/7, so you can vent anytime you need to from the comfort and convenience of your own home. Whether you prefer text, video, or voice messaging, your therapist will engage with you 5 days a week. Match with a licensed therapist today by going to Talkspace.com or downloading the app. As a listener of this podcast, you'll save $100 off your first month with code WONDERY. That's code WONDERY for $100 off at Talkspace.com.
Y'all, don't you love having bright, shiny hair? I know I do. And Madison Reed makes it easy for you to find your perfect shade. All you have to do is go online, take the color quiz, answer a few questions, and they'll recommend the best options for you. Unlike other brands, Madison Reed Color is full of ingredients that nourish your hair. Things like keratin, which infuses hair with protein and keeps color from fading, as well as ginseng root extract. It's incredibly convenient. They deliver it right to your door on your schedule, and it takes less than an hour to process. Just like I said, perfect hair color, bright, shiny, healthy hair. Get ammonia-free, multidimensional hair color delivered to your door starting at $22 at madison-reed.com. Use our promo code BESTCASE and you'll get 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit. Our promo code again is BESTCASE. Visit madison-reed.com now to find your perfect shade.
It turns out that because we had left the scene, because John Coleman wanted us to keep it quiet and not say anything over the air, over the radios or anything like that, other officers had responded to the scene and found the van afterwards and knocked on the door and were talking to the suspect at that point. So it was almost a friendly fire situation. Do you remember that at all?
I'm not sure I was there yet, but I do remember we were all running on fumes at that point, having worked well up until midnight the next night, 6 hours of sleep if we were lucky, then back the next day to do the same thing. So I remember bits and pieces of that part of the story. All I knew is eventually interviewing the owner of the van, he claimed that he had lent it to a friend who may have lent it to a friend. We did clear that friend as not, or I should say the owner, as not being the driver at the scene of the homicide, but so, we did confiscate the van.
Right. Well, I could tell you some more little details about that. When we were in the house, these two senior agents who were, John had wanted to do the interview of this kid, they were sitting there in the living room, and this kid who was like maybe 20 at the most, who owned the van, he was sitting there in front of his parents, and they were asking him all these questions about who he lent the van to and what was the purpose and all this stuff. And I could tell that this kid was extremely nervous. And they're asking him like very detailed questions. And I remember taking the two agents saying, could you wait here a minute? And taking the two agents onto the front porch and saying, what are you doing? You're asking this kid all these questions in front of his parents. If he answers one question, he's going to be seen as a rat. They're going to either want to kill him or throw him out of the family, at least. You got to protect him. And they were like, oh, I don't think that's really the case. He's just being, I said, let's just bring him into our car, which we did. And he said, what are you trying to get me killed? I mean, the first thing out of his mouth. And then he said, look, I'll cooperate with you. I had nothing to do with it. Gus borrowed the van. He said he had to move an engine. And so, you know, he needed my van and he just took it and he bought it back, you know, a few hours later. And that's it. I had no idea. You know, I had nothing to do with it. Well, do you give us permission to seize the van? Yes, we seized the van. And that's when the forensic work started on the van. So that was, again, two sort of major issues that sort of happened that didn't have to happen if there was proper planning and there wasn't sort of fear of jurisdictional issues, we'll call it that.
Well, and Fitz, I think that for me, it's interesting because you've got this urgency of, you know, solving the crime, but you also have the conflict. As a prosecutor, I can't help but think about it. You've got the conflict of you've got to follow procedure. You've got to do your job the way you always do it, because just because the DEA says that the last person the agent met with was this one, you know, Farachi guy, that doesn't mean he's the one who pulled the trigger unless someone actually observed it or there was eyewitness testimony. So you can't rush out and arrest him for murder. You've got to actually build a murder case, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we all, of course, knew that in the meantime, but we knew we already had enough to violate Gus Farachi's or Farace's parole because of just the conversations he had with the DEA agent, which were recorded. I just want to back up a little bit, and anyone in law enforcement can relate to this, prior or retired or present. I'll never forget, back to the scene of the crime itself, Everett Hatcher had three separate follow-up cars trailing him, and they were had monitors, you know, for picking up conversations. Something went wrong that night, and they lost the eye, as we like to say. They somehow lost track of Everett Hatcher, if he was turning left, right, whatever. I mean, they knew where he was supposed to meet with Gus, but somehow they lost him. And I'll never forget looking over at the scene and watching those guys arguing among themselves, and some boss came and was yelling at them. They felt awful because they weren't there to watch what happened to their brother, DEA agent. So getting away from the investigation here, but just, you talked earlier about the interpersonal elements of working a case like this. Can you imagine if you were tasked with keeping an eye on your fellow agent and you lost that eye, he got out of pocket somehow from you, and because you weren't there, at least possibly he was murdered. Although we later found out it happened so fast, Gus just pulling his weapon out of his belt buckle and just fired those three shots downward from the van into a passenger car. So it may not have made any difference, but at least they possibly could have administered first aid, or at least trailed the van to where it had to be immediately stopped. So yeah, a lot of things went wrong the first 48, 72 hours on multiple levels. But the point was, we had to start interviewing people associated with the van. And by the way, forensics, as Jim pointed out, did find evidence of Gus's fingerprints inside the van. Again, you're not going to convict someone on that alone, but it would, in fact, start building the circumstantial case against him. So before long, we're interviewing everybody related to Gus, his pregnant wife, his cousin, his parents, every mob person we could identify even closely related to him. But we found out right away, early on, Gus had no intentions of giving himself up.
That's right.
Wow. So you've got all these mobsters to talk to. What's that like, Fitz? I mean, it seems to me, you always, it's just, you know, the way it's portrayed on TV, mobsters, you know, gangs, they never talk. They never rat out anyone. And they're usually just rude and, if not, you know, sort of dismissive of law enforcement coming to talk to them. So what was it like talking to some of those mobsters about this case?
Yeah. And again, within just to kind of give the listeners a perspective, within about 5 days, within less than a week of the murder, it was decided in Washington, D.C. that a task force would be formed. So it was an FBI-led task force with several DEA agents, several Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms agents, and a few NYPD detectives. And the detectives and a few of the FBI people had La Cosa Nostra or mafia, you know, working experience. I didn't. I certainly read about the mob, watched the movies, but I was a bank robbery guy in New York, and you know, mobsters didn't tend to rob banks. An armored car now and then, as Jim knows about, but not the typical fare we'd be working. So it was really an education for me. And one of the first things that was done after searching for the car and all that is they got phone records out, and not quite as easy then as it is nowadays, because all your numbers are in a cell phone, and I'm sure landlines, it runs the same way, even at some central office. We did get subpoenas, and we found out the hours before the murder and the hours after, there was one number being called repeatedly by Gus, and we were sure that's the phone he was using, and it was to his cousin, Dominic Farachi. And we finally tracked him down. He's another wannabe mobster. These are both nephews of a made guy. And he was on parole for some various violations, all drug related. And he was violated because we put a surveillance team on him. He crossed in New Jersey a few times, which in and of itself is a violation, crossing state lines. He was dealing with other known criminals, a violation. So he was making a bunch of phone calls from phone booths. He wasn't stupid. He didn't want to make them from his home, but the surveillance agents would go out, copy down the phone number, and then get subpoenas for that number to see who's calling who and whatever. And we started putting this case together. His parole was violated. He was brought in, and I wasn't part of that interview team, but I did watch it through a glass window. And eventually they convinced him, you know, tell us what happened. Tell us what your cousin told you, or you have 10 years in jail of back time that, you know, you get out early for on parole. It took him a few days, but he finally realized, okay, yes, Gus is my cousin. Gus killed the DEA agent, but he thought he was doing him a favor. He thought he was providing exculpatory info. But I'll tell you, Gus didn't know he was a DEA agent. He didn't know he was a DEA agent. Would that help when he gets arrested? I said, you know what? That's not for us to determine right now. I mean, there's other agents interviewing him. Let's just get the information. So he told us that it was Gus. He confirmed Gus told him that he killed Everett Hatcher because he thought he was an informant. Not that he was positive he was a DEA agent, but he thought he was an informant.
So you're already building a stronger case. You know, there's absolutely some corroboration there, and that was obviously documented and recorded.
Yep.
So that's good.
And just as importantly, and maybe even more so, Dominic told us where the gun was.
The murder weapon?
The murder weapon. And he took us by, I think I was in one of the trail cars. They had him in handcuffs. These guys all wore, by the way, running suits back then. That was like the mob fashion motif, if you will. All these various track suits, running suits. And most of them are out of shape. They didn't run at all in these things, but they still wore them. So he was in his handcuffs, you know, ankle cuffs, took him by a few of the different kills in Staten Island. And for those not familiar with New York, whatever, a kill is basically a body of water. He said, yeah, it's this bridge. They pulled over and they threw the weapon in here. And we brought the FBI and NYPD dive team in.
I wonder if Bobby Chacon was part of that.
In 89? That's a good question. We'll have to ask him.
Didn't he join in like 92, Jim?
No. He was in the academy when me and Fitz were in the academy. Yeah.
Bobby just has such a baby face. I always forget.
Are you trying to say we look old? I think we're getting insulted, Fitz. I really do.
Well, maybe breathing that oxygen out of a tank on his back did something for his skin. I don't know. But I'll tell you this much. Diving in a kill does not do anything for anyone's skin, because what the agents and divers told me is it is complete darkness. You are examining by feel. You are searching by like feel.
Muddy, mucky, yuck.
Tires and, you know, shopping carts and all kinds of stuff. And they basically said, look, we'll give you 5 days in daylight. And this is like mid-March now. And Monday morning they started. And Friday afternoon at 3:30, still nothing. And a few of us would take turns going out there, watching these dive teams at work. And they come up just full of mud and gunk on them. Finally, literally with an hour of sunshine left, one day in mid-March, an agent comes up holding up a weapon in his hand and said, I found this gun. What do you think? It matched the make, the model, took it to the lab. And within days, we knew it matched the ballistics of the murder weapon. And we could put Gus for, I'm not sure his prints were on it or not with the being in the water, but it definitely other people could. Dominic told us that was his gun. The ballistics matched up. So now the case is really getting much stronger.
Yeah, that is actually very good forensic evidence, even if his fingerprints are not on it, because of the connections that the cousin made. They're circumstantially corroborating the information. And when the weapon was found and it matched the ballistics, that was pretty good evidence that the rest of what the cousin said was true. Fitz, we've kind of moved along pretty far in this, first week of the investigation in the story, but I want to draw your attention back to the first night, the overnight that we worked when we responded to the scene. You and I were actually doing a surveillance, and we were in Staten Island in a neighborhood, and we were sitting there on the grandmother's house of Gus Faraci. And as the light started coming up in the morning, you know, with when sunrise, we noticed that the house that was parallel to us, the house we were watching was sort of catty corner around the corner, but the house to the left, in one of the upstairs windows, we could see the silhouette of someone looking at us. And that was a very chilling moment. And
creepy.
When we come back, we'll have to talk about that. But that'll be next week, because right now we're out of time. And we really appreciate you coming on, Fitz. And we can't wait to have you come back so we can continue talking about this horrific murder and very interesting investigation.
All right, guys.
All right. Until next time, thank you for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production produced by Francie Hakes, Josh Murphy, and Jim Clementi at Empire Studios LA. Engineered and edited by Matt Gergel. Music composed and performed by Simba Sumba and hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness to Light can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.